Our first speaker this morning is Bonnie Keeler. Bonnie is the current graduate research fellow at the Institute of the Environment here at the University of Minnesota and researcher with the Natural Capital Project. She is a PhD candidate in Natural Resources Science and Management here at the University of Minnesota, has a master's in ecology from the University of Minnesota in 2007, and a BA in biology from the Colorado College 2001. Bonnie's talk is entitled The Linking Water and Well-Being, a Framework for Improved Assessment and Valuation of Groundwater-Related Ecosystem Services. Please welcome Bonnie Keeler.
Thank you, Bob. I think I have to move this down. So as Bob said, I work at the Institute on the Environment, which is right across the street here on the St. Paul campus. And I also work with this interdisciplinary team of researchers called the Natural Capital Project. And I'll talk a little bit more about what NatCap does later on in the talk. So I'll say right off the bat that I'm not a geologist, and I actually don't really have any expertise in groundwater. But I'm really excited to be here today to talk about what I do know a lot about, which is how do you work at the interface between ecology and economics, and how do you apply this framework of ecosystem services to hopefully making more informed land use decisions. And I'm particularly interested in being here because one of the areas that we haven't done a particularly good job of addressing, and we hope to do more in the future, is surrounding how we manage groundwater in Minnesota and beyond. So I'm going to talk a little bit about that and hopefully have a little plea at the end for your help in moving that science forward. All right, so a roadmap. I'm going to talk a little bit about sort of the big picture motivation for the kind of work that I do and the kind of work that we do at the Institute on the Environment. I'll talk about a framework for valuing water that we've developed over the last couple of years and are trying to apply to different contexts. And I'll talk about two applications of that framework in Minnesota, one on groundwater in southeast Minnesota, another one on lake recreation. And then finally, I'll talk about this idea of groundwater as an ecosystem service and some of the challenges that we've faced in trying to put groundwater into this framework that we've developed and hopefully get a chance for some feedback on the direction that we're trying to head. Okay, so to take a sort of big picture view of this type of science, and really what we're thinking about are the true consequences of the types of land use and land management decisions that we're making. So whenever there's an action on the landscape, maybe it's agriculture or it's mining or timber extraction, there's this trade-off between the production of private goods and the production of public goods. So if you're growing corn and you're selling it to an ethanol refinery, you get the value of that private good of that corn is reflected by a market for that product. But there's also a whole bunch of other private goods and private costs or public goods and public costs that are generated with all those types of actions and decisions that we make. So there may be changes to water quality, there may be changes to air quality, to loss of habitat, to pollination services. You can imagine all these other sort of public goods that unfortunately don't have markets to capture their values. So we're really having this trade-off between real costs, some of which have markets to reflect their costs, and then some of these public goods that don't have markets, or the market system really breaks down when you're trying to capture the value of those types of impacts. And this is important because markets matter, right? And the trajectory we're seeing in the environment is a reflection of how the importance of markets in influencing what's valued in society. So this is a figure from the Millennium Ecosystem Assessment, which was a publication in 2005 that talked about, see if I can get my pointer to work, there it is, the state of the global state of these valuable ecosystem services. And what I want you to take away from this is just that there's most of the arrows are red and going down, which means that there's been a loss in that type of service or that the provision of that public good. And there's just a couple of blue arrows that are going up, and that's crops and livestock. And these are things that are captured, where values are captured in markets. So clearly where there's a market and there's a signal for a way to capture those values, those are things that society is going to do a better job of producing more of. And things that don't have values or aren't well captured with these market-based tools are in a lot of ways declining across the globe. Okay, so the fundamental hypothesis of this work is that in order to make more informed decisions, we need to do a better job of capturing some of these things that are difficult to value with our current set of economic tools. And the reason that we want to make these, we need this sort of information is to perform a variety of different types of decisions. So I'm going to discuss three different decision contexts really quickly that require information about public goods or the value of public goods. So if you think about when EPA is trying to enact a new regulation, whether it's related to air quality or water quality, they have to demonstrate that the benefits of that regulation exceed the cost of implementing it. So it'll be some cost to manufacturers or to factories to install new pollution reduction mitigation technologies, but are the benefits do the benefits outweigh the cost? And at least for the Clean Air Act, the research has showed definitely, yes, that the benefits of cleaner air far outweigh the cost of implementing new technology. But with the Clean Water Act, this is much harder to quantify because it's very difficult to understand the true value of clean water to society. But this information is really important if we're going to actually do a better job of evaluating the regulations. The other thing that this information can be useful for is trying to figure out how to reward the provision of these public goods. So if you're a landowner and you decide to plant native prairie on your land and that's producing habitat for beneficial insects or for pollinators or for game and non-game wildlife species, you're creating value, you're generating a public good that you're not being compensated for. And so are there ways that we can develop payment schemes or incentive programs or mechanisms to help incentivize or reward people for the production of those public goods that have real value? But in order to do that, we need to have some sort of sense of how valuable they are and who they're benefiting. And then finally, a big focus of our work is trying to think about how we use this information to use scarce resources more efficiently through better spatial planning. So we all have limited resources and how much we can land we can conserve or watersheds we can restore or other types of financial or capital resources to spend on conservation. How do we use those resources most effectively? So how do we target areas to generate the greatest public benefits to society with the limited resources we have? Does that mean buying big tracts of land in northern Minnesota, or is it buying really small patches around suburban neighborhoods that provide water quality benefits or air quality benefits? So these are really important decisions, but they require information on how valuable these public goods are, where they're produced, and who's receiving the benefits of them. Okay, so of course what I'm talking about is this concept of ecosystem services, which many of you have probably heard before. And this is simply all the benefits that people derive from nature. So all of the benefits from natural systems or from ecosystems. And there are sort of two key components of this framework. One is that we're thinking of a really comprehensive suite of benefits. So not just one single impact to water quality, but really thinking fully about the full cost of the decisions we make and the full suite of values that we get from nature. And then also that these values are values to people, that they benefit human well-being in some direct way. And that's a really important component of this definition. So if you're producing a lot of valuable pollination services, for example, but there's no agricultural land to receive the benefits of that pollination, then that's not as valuable as the pollination services provided by a different patch of land that's actually really improving coffee yields, for example, in an adjacent field. The same thing is true for water quality and some of these other services. So this framework can help us to try and quantify the values of these public goods or these externalities that are produced when we make decisions and try and incorporate them better into making more informed decisions as we move forward. And the overall sort of the dream for taking this framework and applying it broadly is that for any given action that you might be considering, whether it's a land use change action or the permitting of a new well or a mine or a timber plot, is that action will generate some kind of environmental change. And we need either a model or a field study to get a sense of how to quantify the magnitude and the direction of that change. And that change will lead to some change in the provision of these valuable public goods or these environmental goods and services. And then we have to think about how that change in the flow of that service will affect human well-being. So who will interact with that change? How will it affect them? Will it affect their health, their recreation, their livelihoods? And sometimes we have to use really sort of creative tools to try and put values on how people experience changes in the environment. So this is sort of the dream. And if we go back to this list, and this is very incomplete list of all of the types of things we might want to consider under an ecosystem services framework. But you can imagine that doing this is much easier for some of these types of services than for others. So if you're thinking about pollination that increases the yield of a crop, well, then there's a market to try and capture that value of that increased yield. But in a lot of these other places, it's much harder to sort of make those links all the way across to value. And probably one of the most challenging components of this framework, which is what I've spent most of my dissertation work working on, is how do we actually put values on clean water services? And I would say that in the time that I've been working on this over the past 5 years or so in Minnesota, this is probably the number one piece of information that decision makers come to our group and ask for. What is the value of clean water? How do we incorporate that value into decision making? And so far, it's probably been the most challenging or the one that we've done sort of the poorest job at being able to provide that information. So there's a big gap between sort of the demand for this information and our ability to supply it. So we're trying to chip away at that problem. All right, so that's sort of the big context for this work. I'm going to talk about the framework that we've presented to try and do a better job on capturing the values of water quality, and hopefully this will be relevant to thinking in a groundwater context. So water quality is challenging to capture the value of for kind of obvious reasons, right? Water quality is a sort of general term that refers to lots and lots of different things. So many different constituents. It could be nitrogen or phosphorus or sediment or contaminants. And those different constituents reach all different sorts of endpoints. So groundwater, surface water, lakes, streams, rivers, coastal areas. And the way people interact with those different constituent changes in those places is very different. So it might be a health impact, it could be a recreational impact, it could be aesthetic value or property values or livelihoods or fisheries. So there's really many, many different kinds of changes that happen in different places driven by different factors that affect people in very different ways across space and time. So this is really complicated to capture kind of the full suite of values associated with a given change in water quality in a single place. So in order to sort of capture this framework, we got a group together about a year ago to sit down and sort of flesh out as much as we could about the science and the economics on water. We brought hydrologists and managers and policymakers and economists and ecologists, and we sat in a room for a couple days and produced sort of a draft framework for how we could move this science forward. And this framework was published last year in PNAS, and it basically follows the same framework that I outlined for kind of all ecosystem services, but really thinking carefully about how do we link the actions or the decisions we're making to changes in water quality, how that affects ecosystems, and how that affects people. So if you get a bunch of people in the room and you start mapping out all this stuff, what you end up with is this really complicated sort of arrow diagram with everything connected to everything else, which is really kind of the truth in the science of water quality. But don't get too overwhelmed by this. I'll step you through an example and then talk about how we've kind of applied this in a practical framework. So basically, you have a constituent like nitrogen. It affects a valuable ecosystem good or service, which is the safety of your drinking water. We have federal standards and regulations around the amount of nitrate we can have in our water. And that the value of that change in that drinking water service can be assessed using either the cost of avoided water treatment or the value of sort of avoided illness from drinking that contaminated water. But of course, nitrogen doesn't just affect safe drinking water. It can affect lots of other things. So it can affect clarity or algal blooms, especially in coastal areas. It can affect fish abundance and productivity, the abundance of pests or parasite, other factors, which are then, of course, are related to a whole other suite of services related to recreation or how people experience different water bodies, and all the sorts of associated values that come along with that. So when you put it all together, you can see kind of why everything is sort of related to everything else. But we knew that this framework itself wasn't particularly useful in practice. It just sort of illustrated the complexity of the problem. And what we wanted to do, like I said earlier, is really develop a set of tools that someone could do to link ecological or biophysical models with economic models to assess the true value of a change in water quality. And so we developed this table, which is to try and do exactly that. So we've I'll give you just a couple of examples of some rows in this and then talk you through some case studies in Minnesota that have applied the framework. So if we take the example of lake recreation, which is something I think we're all kind of are familiar with and can visualize, the most important, if you're going to simplify the problem, the most important constituent here would be phosphorus coming into lakes, and people don't react in their behavior to the concentration of phosphorus in a lake. They react to something they can perceive, which is a good proxy for that is the clarity of the water. So they're making decisions or they're responding to that change in phosphorus and how they perceive how clear the water, how clean the water is. So the beneficiaries of that change in clarity could be people who recreate in the water or it could be people who live near the water. And in each of those cases, there's different valuation tools that are appropriate. So if you're a recreationist, you might be looking at, you could either ask people how much are you willing to pay to have cleaner water than less clean water when you go on your lake visit. Or you could ask them, you know, if you have your choice between traveling 50 miles to go to a lake that's really clear or 20 miles to go to a lake that's not so clear, which choice would you make? And we try and tease out people's preferences for water quality and how they respond to those sorts of survey questions. Or you can actually just look at people's behavior and sort of see where they go on the landscape. And through counts of visits to lakes in different places, you can get a sense of how much, you know, they're revealing to you in their behavior about how they value that particular change in quality. For property values, you can use a hedonic pricing approach and basically look at, you know, are houses that are located on clear lakes more valuable than a similar property located on a less clear lake? So those are just a quick example of how you can kind of go through this framework and link a biophysical model to an economic model for one water quality-related service. So this is an incomplete draft of the whole table, but the point is that we've done this for many different water-related services. You can see there's a groundwater one on the list. And we structured this table such that each of these lines is a unique and additive source of value, so that for any given action that might affect multiple types of water quality changes, you could add up the values for those and get sort of the full or total value of a change in water quality. All right, so this is sort of a nice framework to think about how to do this, and now I'm going to talk about a couple of applications of this in Minnesota where we've really tried to take this and see if we can do it in practice on the landscape. And so the first one I'm going to talk about relates to groundwater, and the context for this is that this paper came out earlier this year in PNAS, and it talks about the trends in land use change across the Midwestern region. And this map shows the change in grassland cover from 2005 to 2011, or 2006 to 2011. So over a relatively short period of time, the dark red and the orange colors are areas where there's been a significant amount of grassland conversion to agriculture. So you can see this trend is especially predominant in a lot of the Dakotas and in parts of Iowa, but good chunks of Minnesota also fall into this trend of significant grassland conversion to row crop agriculture. So we were interested in trying to evaluate what the consequences of this land use change might be for water quality and how people would experience or could experience those changes and what some of the economic costs of this land use change could be to water quality. So again, we're thinking about this land use change is our action. It's going to affect water quality in some way. That'll affect the provision of ecosystem goods and services. And there's probably many different services we could evaluate in the context of this change. If you're thinking about people's recreation behavior, Gulf hypoxia, and drinking water. And in this area, we decided to focus on drinking water quality and how people might experience that change. All right, so many of you know this area of southeastern Minnesota is highly susceptible to contamination by surface water changes due to the geology of the region. And this is also an area where the majority of residents get their water from groundwater sources. So there's reason to suspect in this area that there might be a justification to look at the changes on the land and how that would affect changes in groundwater quality. So and I thank Bob and Tony Runkle for providing a lot of the data that contributed to this study, but this is information from a map of the county well index wells in the southeastern 11 southeastern counties in Minnesota, and then showing wells that exceed contamination thresholds of 10 parts per million for 4 to 10 or less than 4 or less than 1, and then the sort of dark background are just wells that don't have water quality information. So we took a subset of wells that had recent water quality data, recent nitrate data, and looked at how those related to the land use pattern in that region for a baseline land use that was sort of bracketed by the water quality data that we had. And we translated that land cover map into a map of sort of estimated nitrate load based on export coefficients associated with each different land cover type in this region. And so this relates actually to some surface water quality modeling that I've done in another project, but I won't get into the details of the methodology here. I mostly just focus on kind of like the framework that we used. But this is a map showing that's like sort of a subsection of southeast Minnesota, and the black dots are all of the wells that we assessed. And for each well, we assigned a nitrate loading value that was a function of the land cover within sort of an estimated recharge zone of each well. We looked at this land cover from 2007 year, which is sort of at the beginning of this five-year period of where we saw some grassland lost to agriculture, and then in 2012. And in this region there, I should say, there was about a 20 to 30% loss in grassland cover if you're just looking at the national land cover cropland data layers over that five-year period. Okay, so we took information about land cover as well as a whole bunch of other well attributes and a bunch of other factors and sort of threw them into a logistic regression model to try and estimate how land use change might affect the probability of a well exceeding a given threshold of either 4 parts per million or 10 parts per million nitrate. So this is the model calibrated, then was calibrated to those initial well set where we had water quality data, and then we expanded that to all the wells in the area that we had location information for but no water quality data to sort of estimate the estimated amount of contamination for the 20,000 some county well index wells across southeast Minnesota. And that's what's shown in this map. So this is a reflection of the 2007 land cover that we sort of used as our baseline land use scenario, with the estimated wells that exceeded these different thresholds. And in this case, we estimated about 18% of wells were sort of at risk of exceeding a 4 parts per million threshold, and 6% were at risk of exceeding a 10 parts per million threshold. And then we looked at this sort of alternative or agriculture expansion scenario, which is basically just the 2012 land cover map for this region, but reflects a trend in grassland loss to agriculture, to row crops, with associated increase in nitrate loading to areas around each well. And by keeping everything else constant, but just changing that signal of nitrate loading, we got a sense of how that might affect the future trajectory of contamination in this region. So we applied the same model and then estimated an increase in the percent of wells that exceeded each of these two thresholds. And now these are estimates. There's obviously lots of uncertainty surrounding these, but I think that the point we're trying to make is that there seems to be a trend in this direction that because of land use change, it's likely that more wells are going to be at risk of exceeding these contamination thresholds due to changes in surface loading associated with land use change. So we took this information about numbers of wells that might shift into these different categories from our logistic regression model and applied it to cost estimates from the literature. So I did some phone surveys of trying to get estimates on well costs and some other nitrate treatment technologies, and there's been some work here at the U about estimating the costs associated with groundwater well contamination through surveys, and collected some estimates of how much, sort of what the options are that someone has if their well is contaminated, what are the costs associated with those different options. And then through survey information we have from Minnesota, from Ann Lewandowski, about what people are likely to do if their well is contaminated. So, you know, about 30% of people don't do anything. About 20% might build a new well, dig a new well, and the other 20% does treatment, and so on. So we applied those percentages to the numbers of wells that shifted into these different contamination thresholds under these two scenarios and came up with this estimate of about $5.8 to $11 million in cost to the well owners in southeast Minnesota over a 20-year horizon time period. And so there's uncertainty around these numbers, and there's lots of ways we could sort of tweak our assumptions. But I think the point was just to try and figure out a way to link both a biophysical approach to mapping and modeling water quality changes as a function of land use change to linking that with some economic data on costs. All right, so that's all I'm going to talk about that piece. And I just wanted to really briefly share with you one other project that's trying to do the same sort of approach, but in the context of lake recreation. So in this case, going back to the framework, what we're really trying to do is capture the value of how people perceive and respond to changes in water quality in Minnesota. And to do this, we used a really, what I think is a really interesting approach. And I can't take credit for this idea, but my colleague at Stanford came up with this really brilliant idea to get an index of visitation using geotagged Flickr photos. So basically, to do this sort of work, typically and understand where people recreate and where they travel, we have to do surveys, which is a pretty expensive way to collect data. It's time-consuming. It takes a long time to do. And so we wanted to figure out what kind of proxy we could use if we didn't have survey data to figure out where people go on the landscape. And so trying a bunch of different things, they looked at looking at tweets and other types of social media, but ended up deciding to do to look at querying the photo sharing website Flickr to get information about where people take photos as a proxy for where people visit. So this is a map of all of the lakes that had spatial data in Minnesota and in Iowa. And the colors, the darker blue, are areas that received more photo user days. So more people took more pictures and uploaded them to Flickr in the dark blue lakes than in the light green lakes across the state, across Minnesota and Iowa. And we included Iowa in this sample because we had actual survey data for Iowa lakes. And so this is just a regression of the Flickr predicted photo user days or Flickr predicted visitation versus the surveyed visitation in Iowa lakes, where we had numbers of people that took trips to different lakes in Iowa. And you can see that there's a relationship there that seems to be that the Flickr photo user day is a pretty decent proxy for actual visitation to lakes. And actually, this sort of validation exercise has been replicated in probably 25 different places and contexts all around the world, and it seems to do a pretty good job as a proxy for visitation. So we have these data, and now we can ask the question. So we know there's a big gradient in water quality and lake water quality across Minnesota and Iowa, from very clear lakes to very not clear lakes, and try and assess whether that water quality signal is actually influencing where people go. Okay. Do people change their behavior in response to changes in water quality? So we can both ask, how does the number of visits change as water quality changes, and also how far do people travel as water quality changes? And it turns out that in this case, this is the number of photo user days and water quality ends up, lake water clarity measured by Secchi depth turns out to be a significant predictor. It's significantly and positively related to photo user days. And then the second way that we looked at this information was doing a route network analysis, so we can actually figure out if for a subset of users of Flickr that post their hometown information on their profile, we can mine that information and map their hometown or their origin as well as each lake that they visited. So we can get an estimate of both of sort of the travel cost of taking a visit. So do people travel further to visit clear lakes than less clear lakes? The answer was yes, and this is a map of all of the lakes and all of the hometowns that we included in the analysis and then the routes that people took to visit different lakes across the state. So both in terms of the distance traveled or the travel cost to visit lakes as well as the number of visits to different lakes, there was a strong signal that people are responding to changes in water quality and expressing their preferences for both where they go and how much time they're willing to trade off to go to lakes that are clear versus less clear. All right, so I just wanted to wrap up with a discussion about groundwater ecosystem services and how we're trying to think about taking some of the ideas that we've developed on linking biophysical models and economic models to inform decision making with this idea of doing something about groundwater. And the Natural Capital Project that I mentioned before is sort of trying to lead this effort of mainstreaming ecosystem services or providing tools that people can use to really capture the value of these public benefits or these public goods or these externalities in decision making and then incorporate them into tools that people can use to inform decisions. So this is a collaboration between the University of Minnesota, the Institute on the Environment here, Stanford University, the World Wildlife Fund, and the Nature Conservancy. And we've done this work now all across the world in a variety of different decision contexts, and this is a very incomplete map of some of the kind of deep dives or project engagements that we've done, but the point here is that this project is really sort of taking off, and the demand for this information is huge right now. We're trying to figure out how to be really strategic about developing new models and tools to support decision-making across the globe. And the sort of fundamental tool that we have in our toolbox is this set of ecosystem service models called INVEST. And these are spatially explicit ecosystem service models that link, for most cases, land use change to changes in the flow of these ecosystem goods and services, and then link them with economic tools so that you can get outputs both in sort of biophysical terms, like tons of carbon sequestered, as well as economic terms. And this is just a diagram of some of the models that are within this INVEST modeling suite. And I encourage you to check out our website if you want more information about INVEST. And we also run trainings here once a year or so if people are interested in learning more about the models. But there's a bunch of different models that deal with a whole bunch of different services. But the water quality models that we have in our toolbox right now are just a really simple sort of annual water yield model and then a nutrient retention or nutrient export model. And these models don't consider groundwater-surface water interactions at all or have anything to do with groundwater supply or groundwater recharge. So we recognize that when we've gone out in the world and tried to apply some of these tools, we keep getting feedback that we're not addressing any, we're really ignoring this groundwater piece and that people want that information. So this is an example just to give you an idea of what the outputs of an INVEST model might look like. This is for the decision context here is permitting a new mine in Colombia. And so in a traditional sort of you're just looking at market tools, you might look at just the value of the mine and the cost of building it. But we're encouraging people to look at a broader set of consequences. So looking at changes in nutrient export and changes in sediment export as a function of kind of where that mine is sited. And then trying to put some values on changes in these services. So the idea is if we had some sort of groundwater tool, it would be, you know, falling into the same sort of context where we could produce spatial maps that give some give people some more, another layer of information about when they're making a land use decision, how they might want to consider groundwater impacts in making that decision. So that brings me to the question of, like, well, what are groundwater ecosystem services, and you guys are much more experts in this area than I am, so I'd love to just continue this conversation afterwards if people have some thoughts on this, but this is sort of how we've been thinking about it and scoping it a little bit, and thinking about groundwater ecosystem services as water storage. So these aquifers are providing a storage function, and perhaps if you didn't have that underground storage, you would have to build a reservoir instead, or you'd have to think of some other way in which to store water. This is especially important in the West, maybe not so much in Minnesota. They provide purification services, so whether it's a surface ecosystem that's providing a denitrification service, or just the aquifer structure itself that's providing some sort of water purification service. There's an obvious water supply service, so your pumping costs might change as your water levels change. Groundwater feeds many groundwater-dependent ecosystems, so lakes and wetlands and rivers and streams, and those ecosystems then provide valuable benefits, right? So they provide trout recreational opportunities, or they provide carbon sequestration in wetlands or habitat or water purification services. And so as groundwater levels change, the vision and value of those ecosystem services provided by those groundwater-dependent ecosystems also changes. Avoided subsidence. If you pump too much, you could have subsidence. So there's that sort of physical storage structure service that groundwater and aquifer systems provide. But we really want to think about this in the context of decisions and actions that people are considering. So if you change something on the landscape, you have a new well that's permitted or a new sort of land management practice, that's going to lead to some sort of change, potential change in groundwater quality, and it could lead to a change in groundwater quantity through change in land use, through recharge, or could, you know, pumping rates could affect the quantity of water. And that could change different aquifer ecosystem services, like pumping costs. It could change groundwater-dependent ecosystems, and then obviously sort of changes in water quality that affect health or treatment costs. And then those changes in groundwater-dependent ecosystems lead to different services. And, of course, the idea is that we can take this information and feed it back into decision-making to make more informed decisions in the front end of this. So we're trying to think about how to sort of screen actions and which of these types of services might be the most important to capture in different kinds of decisions and which of these are most sensitive to the kinds of threats or changes that are on the landscape. So again, just like linking groundwater back into this framework, trying to be really strategic about how we attack this problem. And thinking about as the change, what the changes are. So are they change in recharge? Is it a change in quality? Is it a change in extraction or pumping rates? And then what the valuable goods and services are that are affected by those changes. So is it cost? Is it treatment, health impacts, loss of aquatic habitat, property values, recreational activities? So you could think of kind of a full list. So doing this sort of screening approach of thinking about not just all the services provided by aquifers, but which services are most likely to change in the future, which ones are under threat, and which values are going to be the most important to bring into the decision-making context. And then finally, we're really thinking about, are any of these relationships generalizable? So groundwater is really complicated. Can you even imagine a generalizable tool that could be used in a lot of different decision contexts that would provide some sort of useful information? Or is this just too complicated to ever replicate or scale up? And then finally, just thinking carefully about if these models or tools might lead to a better decision relative to the kinds of decisions that are being made right now. So we never have the perfect model, but could we think of a good enough model that would help us to make more informed decisions than currently being made? So I'm just going to close by putting those same three questions up that I started with. And thinking about groundwater in the context of these. So are there regulations that we need to evaluate the cost-benefit ratio of that having information on groundwater-related services would be important in informing those calculations? Or how do we reward landowners or people who are practicing good groundwater and aquifer, generating good groundwater and aquifer-related public goods? And can we provide incentive programs or payments to help encourage those kinds of activities in the landscape? And what information do we need in order to do that? And then finally, thinking about how we use resources more efficiently and targeting spatial planning and what kind of information about groundwater do we need in order to make better, more targeted spatial planning decisions and use resources more efficiently. And of course, you guys all know that this is the context of groundwater and threats to groundwater changing across the state. And I'd love to get your feedback on kind of how you think we can couch this decision-making toolbox in the context of some of the threats that are on the landscape. All right, so I'll put my email and contact information up again and encourage people to get in touch with me if they're interested in talking about ecosystem services or groundwater. If you get an email from me sometime in the next year about trying to set up a working group to think about this, you'll at least have some background about where it's coming from. Do you have some time for questions?
Yeah,
okay.
So, yes, we have time for questions. Yep, back here.
Have you thought about using this model to evaluate White Bear Lake?
No.
Why not?
Well, you know, this gets into this thing about, like, I wonder the question, like, what if we had the kind of tool that we could be capable of producing, like a pretty simple, generalizable tool, would that have ever been able to capture or to would that have caught that issue, right? Like, would we have been able to detect that change before it became this big problem? And I don't know the answer to that because I don't understand, you know, how much of the geology of that situation would be generalizable or would have been detectable without a detailed modeling study of that region. What I'm interested in are kind of these sort of what sort of an approximation or a screening tool that we can use that might help us detect situations like a White Bear Lake and avoid those in the future. But this is really beyond my expertise to evaluate whether or not that could have been detected using a simple tool or if you had to have sort of detailed modeling to do it. But that's sort of the goal would be that you could have some kind of tool or screening tool that would be able to detect those sorts of problems before they become White Bear Lake problems.
Other questions? Eric?
This is really cool stuff. I'm in an ongoing debate with a colleague about the efficacy of market mechanisms on dealing with some of these problems in particular.
Like wetland mitigation and stuff, it's the same idea. But
The argument I get into is, well, that's species specific, right? I mean, you're looking at the benefits to one species. So if you were a lake trout economist, or if economists were smart enough, or if lake trout were smart enough to have economists, then wouldn't they come to a completely different solution? And I don't know how to answer that. So how do you deal with questions like that? Well, this is very selfish. We're trying to maximize the benefit to human population, but we're not looking at benefits, you know, across the board. So how do you? Or do economists, by definition, only maximize the benefits to the human species? So that's my question.
Yeah, so those are really good questions, and yes, they're things that we wrestle with. So I think there's two pieces to that. One is that the idea is to not focus on single benefits, but to focus on multiple benefits. To cast the widest net, to just under the hypothesis that more information is going to lead to better decisions. What you may do with it what you will, but wouldn't it be nice to know all of the impacts to trout and wetlands and habitat and carbon and water and sediment and groundwater recharge and that full suite? And then you can make some decisions with your stakeholder groups or your policymakers and say, well, which of these do people actually value more than others? And you could weight them and then make, you know, those sort of decisions. And you may decide to sort of disregard all this economic analysis and just say what we care about is protecting trout, and we're just going to do that anyway. But at least we kind of know about all these other impacts. That's sort of how I see it. People get really caught up in this idea of putting values on nature or reducing these things to numbers. And I actually think it's more just sort of putting more information out on the table. And we've certainly in our applications have seen it's not so much about the dollar values or the economic numbers that people care about, but when you take an environmental change and you connect it to people, like that someone's livelihood or someone's health or someone's property values or their recreational activities are being affected, that sort of carries a different weight than just saying, you know, we're increasing nutrient export. Well, what does that, you know, who's that really affecting? What does that mean to people? And so translating some of those environmental changes that we know are really important, but linking some of them to impacts on people can carry some greater weight with decision makers. That helps to answer your question.
Time for one more question. Brian?
Thanks for your talk today. One question I was thinking of, do you think the number of dollars associated with increasing crop production in southeast Minnesota, which is what your map was showing, the number of dollars associated with that is greater than the number of dollars that are assigned to taking care of problems with your well, drilling new wells, right, because of increased nitrate contamination?
The answer to that is yes. And I have actually done that calculation. The value of if you put, you know, especially with, well, crop prices are going down now, but if you, depending on your assumption about corn and soybean prices in that region and the numbers of acres that are new in production and the value of those, the revenue generated from those, it far eclipses the numbers from these groundwater costs.
Okay. Then I would suggest that maybe dollars are not a very accurate measure of that idea.
Yeah, well, I think I don't know about accurate or inaccurate, but I think, so there's two things I'll say to that. One is that those numbers are likely underestimates of the true value of nitrate loading to that system, and it's not considering all of the other ecosystem services that are affected by grassland conversion to agriculture. So there's loss in carbon sequestration, there might be loss in habitat, there's sediment erosion, there's all sorts of other impacts, and we're not valuing any of those. So, right, so you could think about a much more comprehensive way of looking at this problem that would try to get at that true sort of value. It's not looking at the health impacts of someone who's drinking contaminated water. And when you start putting people's health and assigning some values to reduced incidence of disease, those numbers all of a sudden get gigantic. They can get really big really fast.
Okay.
So I agree that that this is sort of an incomplete estimate, and that it's really what I think is sort of not about the numbers also. I think it's really just about connecting the sort of full cost of actions and decisions all the way to people.
Yeah, I agree with you, but it is the dollars that drive a lot of behaviors, as you know.
Yeah.
And unlike other things which are physical and can be measured, a dollar is not a physical thing, except the paper in your wallet. You know, it's not a gallon. Mm-hmm. It's not a watt. You know, it's not a BTU or something like that. Mm-hmm. Those things can be incentivized in ways that physical things can't. And so that mm-hmm. obviously drives our behavior in certain ways because certain people want it to be driven that way.
Right, exactly. Yeah, and I think the response I have to that is, like, the way that we, without doing this calculation, the value is zero. And we know that the value is not zero, and so we're trying to at least approximate what that, we know it's not zero, we know it's something, so let's, even though it may not be perfect and it may not be this, like, gigantic, huge number that everybody wants it to be, we're still making a point that there are real costs, and those costs are as real as the value of that corn. Even if they don't exceed the value of that corn, they're still real costs affecting real people, and that's important, I think.